Welcome to Ira's Everything Bagel, where I talk with intriguing people about everything, their passions, pursuits, and points of view. What happens after a career in the FBI? Well, for some, retirement marks the beginning of a whole new mission. That's exactly the path my guest chose, becoming a storyteller and author. Tony Mozingo is author of Beyond the Badge, One Man, Two Lives, a gripping exploration of the delicate balance between duty and personal identity. Available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the usual places. And for everything about Tony, go to MozingoZone.com, MozingoZone.com, and you can follow him on Instagram, YouTube, and TikTok. And Tony, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ira. I'm glad to be here.
Thanks. Well, it's an interesting last name. Why don't we start with that, and then we can get into the book and to why you wrote it.
Well, the last name is interesting as well. It seems that there was a
well, that's the one I referred to, not Tony, but Mozingo.
Oh yeah, it's a Bantu African name, and we learned this from a Joe Mozingo, who had been a features editor for the LA Times. He wrote a book after doing a couple of years of research, and he found that there's not that many Mozingos in America, like 400,000. He said that he found that every one of them was related to an Edward Mozingo, who arrived in a Virginia colony in about 1630, but he came from Angola and he was a black man, and so this story unravels how his life expanded from there, and his children procreated and. His boys, one married into the white community and one married into the black community, and they followed it on. So today, even to this day in Tidewater, Virginia, there are black Mozingos and white Mozingos who live next door to each other that have no idea they're related.
That's funny. That's great. Well, you've had a great career as an FBI agent, and then you retired, and you decided to become a storyteller. Why? As opposed to, I don't know what people normally do when they retire. I guess it depends on their interest. But what was your interest in storytelling? And then you end up writing the book. Again, it's called Beyond the Badge, One Man, Two Lives.
My main interests have always been reading. After I retired, I began writing short stories. And I read a philosophy book called Six Great Ideas of Mankind by Mortimer Adler. And those ideas were truth, virtue, beauty, liberty, equality, and justice. And after I read that, I realized that of all the number of the cats that I had over my life and still had at the time, one of those great ideas melded with their personality. And so I started writing stories about, first I had to create a way that I could talk to them. And then I started writing individual stories about the particular idea with the particular animal, and it was just something to do after my retirement, and I just had a lot of fun doing it.
Were any of your fellow agents who have retired gone in that direction, either writing books or talking to cats or anything like that?
I'm the only one I've run across because we have a monthly meeting here of the retired agents group and a monthly luncheon here in Las Vegas and haven't met anybody yet.
Okay, well that's fair. Since you do have that monthly meeting, but when you tell them what you did in terms of the book, are they surprised or did they know that there was a book in you?
They were surprised because they didn't know me that well. I had retired out of the San Francisco division. I had been the local agent in Monterey Carmel, and for the last 10 years of my career, and I was new here, and anything I might come up with probably didn't surprise them.
Makes sense. What led you to join the FBI?
Oh, you know, I really wanted to be a Marine Corps officer, but it was summertime work in high school. I really ruined my knees doing construction work, and so when I attempted to join the Marine Corps, they wouldn't accept me. So the next best thing was the FBI,
and they accepted you even with the bad knees.
Well, they weren't really that bad, but they're bad enough to be a Marine.
Got it. And you grew up in rural Virginia, so that's a different outlook that you have than some of us grew up in an urban environment. What was your view of the FBI when you joined it at the time? Were you influenced by, oh, there was the FBI series with Efren Zivilis Jr. and several other versions of the FBI as well, and the whole history. Did that influence you in any way, or did you just take it as it was and with no illusions about what the organization was?
Well, that was part of it. I grew up in a very rural area. My dad was 12 or 13 children, and we lived on a farm, a small farm. And so I didn't have that much experience with law enforcement personally. Most of it came from watching TV as a little boy. And in those days, in the 50s, the big shows were all westerns and say, crime shows like Dragnet. So that's where my I grew up with the idea that law enforcement is an honorable profession and a key to our society.
So you weren't influenced by Efren Zivilis Jr., but by Jack Webb.
That's a fair way to say it.
But then you didn't join the local police force or the local sheriff's office. You decided to go national.
That was a different story. They kind of decided for me in a way because I was in a job that I had at the time right after I graduated from the University of Virginia. I was working as a salesman for TWA, and we stopped by the FBI office because one of the agent I was with was had their account there. And on the on just out of, on a goof, I stopped by the employment office and filled out an application. Never gave it that much of a thought until about 3 weeks, three, I guess about 3 months later, I got a phone call one night and says, "Are you still interested in becoming an FBI agent?" And I said, "Well, sure, who wouldn't?" And that was it. I went in for an interview, and they asked me the same question: "Why do you want to be in the FBI?" And I said, "Well, I really wanted to be a Marine officer, but I had bad knees." And the guy looked at me and says, "That's the only honest answer I've ever got to that question."
They accepted you as a result of the honest answer. That's great.
I think it had something to do with it,
It was a different world than when you joined the FBI. Was there an extensive background check on you? Did they know about your fondness for cats and your growing up in rural Virginia?
They found out that, extensive background is having done some of those myself in my early career. They talked to everybody, and especially my coworkers and other jobs I'd had, and anybody else who was key in my life. And that's true. That's a true statement.
Well, when you mentioned you've done some background checks as well, and I want to get a little bit more in terms of what you did in the FBI, and then we talk about the book. But in the FBI itself, if you were doing it, for my listeners and viewers, again, it's the pollen that causes my voice to sound this way. So it's another few weeks, I'll be back to normal. But at any rate, when you were working in the FBI and you were doing background investigations at one point, as you mentioned earlier, how much is that a grinding piece of work as opposed to stimulating work? Because you're contacting people, you're looking at documents, you're seeing how far back you can go. Did he really shoplift when he was in the fourth grade? How far back are you going, and what's the process for that?
Well, it varies depending upon the level of job that the government employee is seeking. For agents, there's an extensive background that we do. For a lesser level, just clerical people and around the country, maybe not so deep. But on the other hand, when you do those cases, when you're doing a background investigation on a potential judge or a U.S. attorney, then it gets quite different. And early on in my early career, I did that's the kind of assignments that you get, because what it does as a new agent, it puts you out on the street, gets you accustomed to identifying yourself and acting as and using the authority that you have, and learning how to interview people.
And I would imagine throughout your career, you've come across all kinds of interesting characters, both criminals and non-criminals. In other words, you're dealing with the public in a lot of cases. You're dealing with judges, as you mentioned, with background checks, and you're dealing with criminals. So you have a whole range, and some judges who probably became criminals. So you have all that going on too. But yeah, but did you find satisfaction in those early years when you're doing, in essence, grunt work? It's important grunt work, but it's still grunt work. It's not a high-profile case that you're investigating at that point.
I would have to say that, the earliest, my first office was Buffalo for a year. My second office was Boston, and I did basic criminal type work, unlawful flight to avoid prosecution, fugitives, stuff like that. But I volunteered to go to Russian language school, which the bureau offered at that time, and so I spent. Early on in my career, I spent a year in Monterey, California at the Defense Language Institute and learned to speak Russian.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that was the case. Do you still speak it today?
Only sovsem zabyl, which means I forgot everything.
You mentioned it being in Boston. This may have been before his time or during his time, but Whitey Bulger is a name that pops up with the Boston area with the FBI. Were you in the FBI during that time in Boston?
I was, but I was just doing basic criminal work, and the guys involved in the Cosa Nostra and Mafia, they were senior guys who were above my level at that time.
Gotcha. What was the most exciting case you worked on? And then we'll talk about your book and why you decided to write it. What was the most exciting case for you? Maybe not the word exciting, stimulating, important, profound, any of those adjectives, or all of them.
Well, I spent most of my having studied Russian, I spent most of my career in working foreign counterintelligence, working against the Soviet GRU, which is military intelligence. And the military intelligence guys were a little more active than the KGB. KGB was were trying to develop influencers and within the community. The GRU were really focused on trying to recruit Americans in military positions and operate them as assets. So that was what I did mostly. At one point, I had moved my way up through the management of ranks and had even been had put in three or four years at FBI headquarters in the unit that managed the GRU activities all across the country. But when I was finally transferred to San Francisco, I stumbled across the opportunity to take a cut in pay and move down and become one of the two agents that was covered Monterey Carmel. And it's one of the two or three places that people really longed to go to or wished to go to. And so I was the lucky guy. In Virginia, we have a saying called, "Even a blind hog finds an acorn every now and then." And that was the biggest acorn that I'd ever found in my career. So,
How long were you there?
10 years, my last 10 years. I retired in 95 out of that office. And I had a wonderful working companion who he and I, we split the work. He did most of the reactive work, and I did foreign counterintelligence and and white collar crime in particular. A lot of bank frauds, a lot of fraud cases.
So crime is, no matter where you go, even in an idyllic setting like Monterey, it's going to be there.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, no, that's good. How do you retain, I get the sense that you have a sense of humor. How do you retain that throughout the years working with cases that could become grim or people that can become very obnoxious or just the criminal mind itself? How do you keep that sense of humor about you?
Well, it's mostly you just share it with your family and your friends, and I think maybe that had something to do with me starting to write a little bit because the things that I wrote had a sense of humor to it. And going back to your original question, one of the most interesting cases that I handled was in the later years in Monterey, and it was a case that I like to call "Catch Me If You Can." It was a local builder, developer, who was very well known in the Monterey area, and as a result of having a good background in his career, he was well thought of in the area banks, and he could obtain unsecured loans that other people couldn't even dream of getting. And at one point, in about, I guess it was 91 or 93, I've got a note here, but He'd obtained what in today's dollars would amount to about $50 million. And when he obtained that, he had a secret life going. What he did was he divorced his wife, and he and his girlfriend took off on a worldwide tour of, just traveling and living a new life. And so, our job was to run him down and get him arrested and get some restitutions on some of those loans. And that's where it really, really got interesting, because the guy, he was a kind of a gadfly. He knew a lot of people in the area, and he knew that we were looking for him at that time. And we didn't know where he was traveling. And what he would taunt us, he would call his friends and people that he knew in the local newspapers and taunting, "Oh, the FBI, they can't find me. They're not going to get me." And so that was part of the, of course, they had to go after him for the money anyway. But to tell you more about the case, the way it started was, you started with just a basic background interview, investigation, in which case I had stumbled across the fact that very early on, he had worked for the post office and he'd been fingerprinted. Okay. I got the lab to print me up, dozens of copies of this on a photographic piece of paper, 8.5 by 11 photograph. And not knowing where he was in the world, but knowing that he was traveling all around the country, Latin America, Europe, anywhere, and writing back to us and said, "Hey, I'm here, but you haven't got me yet." He was taunting us. It kind of got under my skin a little bit, but you can't let that be your problem. So anyway, what I did was, in all major embassies around the world, the FBI maintains a legal attaché, and the legal attaché is a works for the embassy and coordinates legal issues between the two countries. And so, what I did was, I sent a copy of those fingerprints to every legal attaché around the world where I could conceive that he might end up at one point, because if we ever did catch him, we had to be able to identify him. Mm-hmm. And that would do the trick. So that took some time to get done. And so then best I could do would try to interview some of his, try to get someone to help me who was in contact with him, so we get a better idea where he was. And of course, we didn't know what name he was using. And luckily, a local person who had worked for him before had gotten himself into an issue with the law and came to the FBI for some help. And he said, "I can help you because I sold my identity to Craig McFarland." Okay, that's step number two. Now we know what name he's using. So and we know that we found out he had been issued a passport in Honolulu, not in Maui, Hawaii. So now we knew his name, but he still didn't know where he was. So I went through the background of friends and in contacts with them. I was able to uncover a gentleman who knew him well enough so that he was trusted to talk to McFarland every now and then, and we get an idea of where McFarland was at the time. And I encouraged him to. Encouraged him to contact us when he got a phone call. And so he did give us a call one day. He says, "He's going to be in Monaco." And okay, he's going to be in Monaco. So I got on the horn with our legal attaché in Paris, who covers Monaco. And he had given the source had given me the hotel where he was going to stay. And the Monaco police went directly to that hotel, and they found out he had just checked in, but he had gone to dinner. So they went over to dinner, and they approached him in a restaurant and said, "Craig McFarland, you're under arrest. We have a warrant for your arrest." He says, "Oh, no, that's not me. That's not me." He says, "We think it is. Let's go down and take a look at your fingerprints." So I always thought he must have had a terrible lump in his throat when he heard that. But
you got your man. Very good.
Got your man, yeah. But even better, well, I got a phone call from Legat Paris at 4 a.m. in the morning. That was just, I was very happy to be awakened at that time. But the next night, I got another phone call, and they said, Liget Perez says, you're not going to believe this. We searched his room, and we found a little black book. And we looked, it was a pencil recording of his. It said, where the money is. And so I mean, our next problem was going to be locating whatever money he had. And it showed where he'd been all around the world to places where he'd safely deposit the money and have access to it later. So that was the end of the case. That was probably my most interesting case. Yeah.
That was great. So is the reason you wrote this book, Beyond the Badge, One Man, Two Lives, It talks about your career in the FBI, but the other life is the life of a storyteller, right?
Cat lover.
And all of that. So how did you meld those two together within the book? What approach did you take?
Well, after I had retired, I moved to Hawaii and found myself thinking back through, I've always been a little interested in philosophy. And so I had read a book called by Mortimer Adler, an American philosopher, called Six Great Ideas of Mankind, Truth, Virtue, Beauty, Liberty, Equality, Justice. And when I read that book, I realized that of the animals that I had as pets, including my border collie named Bonnie, between Bonnie and the cats, each one of those, their personalities fit one of those six great ideas. And so I just sat down and started writing conversations with them. I had to invent a way that I could talk to them.
Right, you mentioned earlier, right?
Approach. So I just talked to them, and so each story, when you put it all together, was a book.
Interesting. So do the cats become FBI agents in the book?
Oh no! They're definitely pests. Yeah. Now the on the other hand, the border collie was the primary subject of the talks, and because she was you know, border collies are very, very smart, and so she was the key player. Yeah.
When you, I like the title, the part of the title which is Beyond the Badge. So It's clearly your new life, for want of a better term. Your current life actually probably makes more sense, because you've put the badge aside, and clearly you have a great history with the badge, and now you're leading a different life. So do you see yourself being the life of an author? I know that you're active on social media, and I mentioned where you are, and I'll mention it again in just a moment, on some of the social media channels. But are you looking to write more books, or is this the initial book that want to kind of sets the stage for what you want to do?
Well, I really enjoy writing. My favorite activities are reading, writing, and I enjoy science too. Science, but I do have plans to. I've written a number of short stories and of different lengths, and I would hope maybe someday to put those together as a group and maybe have a publishment there. That's right now. It's too close to getting the first one done to plan too far ahead.
Well, what do you want people to take from your book, or learn from your book, or enjoy from your book, or all three of those things?
Well, I hope they like the FBI stories that we chose, and we chose to add those. As when I had written all the short stories about the cats and the interaction with six great ideas, all of my friends and my wife in particular, Donna, encouraged me that's to try to get this published. And they gave me some encouragement. And Donna, in fact, even said, you know, whatever it takes, let's try to get it done. And so that's how the idea of the book began. And even though everybody liked the animal stories, the thought of because I'd been an FBI agent and interjected some FBI stories that would help the publication of the book. And so that's where we are. And that's where we got to today.
So how do you interject the FBI stories in it? Is it, in other words, one chapter is FBI stories, the next chapter is about one of the cats, and then the third chapter is back to the FBI? Is that how you worked it, or?
It's essentially autobiographical, and it starts with being growing up on a farm and not having not having to run of water in the bathroom until I'm eight till I was 8 years old. And it was kind of a poor background, but I worked my way up. And it is autobiographical, and of course then at some point that becomes the FBI, and that's how the two different stories became, you know, occurred. Yeah.
Did you have to get a clearance from the FBI on any of the stories you wrote about?
Oh, yeah, that's another story in itself. Well, there's a thing called the pre-publishing unit in the FBI, and once you're done with your manuscript, you send them a copy, and months later, after they've read it, they give the okay, and or they suggest any changes, or say, you know, too many cuss words, something like that.
How did your book go in terms of that review?
It only took a couple of months, and they didn't have any changes. I think there was only one word where I used a cuss word, but that was something that one of our trainers used in an interesting situation.
Interesting. Yeah, I thought maybe they would have said, well, you can't reveal this piece of information because it's too confidential, that type of thing. But you didn't have an issue with your...
There was certainly that. But because of my history, I knew what I could say and what I couldn't say.
Right, right.
And there had been a previous book published about a major double agent case that had lasted for 20 years. So I knew anything that was in that book had already passed muster. And that gave me a guideline to go by.
I think I got a great marketing idea for you, which is to also put the book out in Russian.
Ooh. Yeah, well,
I just figured what the hey, you know.
unfortunately, even though I did at least half of my time in foreign counterintelligence working with Russians, that's the least amount that I can. That's the least amount of time that I can give to the stories. Most of the stories are in the criminal side. Yeah, right. Yeah.
If there's one lesson before I let you go, if there's one lesson you want people to take away from your life, not necessarily the book, but just in terms of, and you talked about the book that you read that inspired you to write the book, but is there one lesson about your life that you'd like to share with our audience?
I suppose it would have to be my general attitude about life. I've become very, very interested in Stoic philosophy with Marcus Aurelius and his memoirs and others. I managed to get through my life by just accepting it is what it is. And that even if it's something might vex you, you know, you have the ability to deal with that. And so I think it's just not letting yourself become overwhelmed by any negative downturn in your life and not getting particularly proud of yourself if something goes right.
Well, that's a great way to leave it. I like it. My guest is Tony Mozingo. He's author of Beyond the Badge, One Man, Two Lives, which delves into the balance between duty and personal identity. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the usual places. For everything about Tony, including ordering the book, go to MozingoZone.com, Mozingo, M-O-Z-I-N-G-O, MozingoZone.com. And you can follow him on Instagram, YouTube, and TikTok. And Tony, thanks for being on the show.
And Ira, thank you for having me. And I've been a pleasant conversation. Enjoyed it.
Thank you. Same here. And join us every Thursday for a new schmear on Ira's Everything Bagel.